So, yeah, I did. I wrote a book on a popular book on particle physics about 5 years ago. So, okay. So, I wanted to talk today about radiator penguin transition rates. It's a good window on new physics. So, I'll talk about the general motivation. And there's going to be two different transitions, the S gamma and the D gamma penguins. And so, not that any measurement in particle physics is easy, but this is difficult, and this is sort of more difficult. But this one also is perhaps even more promising. I'll mention the generic arguments for that, and I'll just kind of wrap up what was said. So the very overall generic argument for why these are interesting is that this is, in the standard model, this is a higher order process. There's 2 E plus 1 electromagnetic vertex. So new physics can look entered at leading order. And the photon would be generated here off of any charged leg. And so, you know, it's one of these cases where you have new physics and the standard model is suppressed and the new physics can rear its head. And I'll be a little more concrete about that, both in the context of S gamma and D gamma in a moment, but this is just a generic argument. And so, but it is a rare decay. It's kind of, you know, a half times 10 to the minus 3 for S gamma, and a factor of roughly 30 below that, as we'll see, for D gamma. So one decay in 10 to the minus 5. But you can reconstruct these because the isolated high-energy photon is a powerful signature. This is basically recoiling against a hadronic system, so it's a kind of a quasi-two-body decay. So the photon is stiff, and, of course, everything is in at rest and center mass, effectively, so everything's fairly isolated also. So it's a fairly relatively clean signature, and one can do these sorts of measurements. So now let's talk specifically about B goes S gamma, and it's a particularly strong constraint, as we'll see on the supersymmetric MSSM parameter space. So I'll talk about that, and I'll talk about the most productive approach to date, which is an inclusive approach that has certain problems that we'll see, and then other approaches that can complement this inclusive approach that are promising. And then that'll be about half the talk. The other half will be on the B goes to D gamma transition. So this shows the kind of reach that you can get with B goes to S gamma just by measuring the rate and comparing to what you expect. And new physics, if you put in a concrete model such as the MSSM model, it will show up and it will affect that transition rate. It shows up elsewhere, but the transition rate is the most direct constraint on this particular model. And typically what one does is one plots the parameter space in the plane of the ratio of vacuum expectation values and the mass of the pseudoscalar Higgs boson that arise in the MSSM model. And you can see that this B goes S gamma constraint does a fairly good job of restricting the parameter space. So one, takes a favorable set of variables and shows just how well one can constrain the parameter space using this measurement. But we can be a little more objective. So, for instance, back in 2001, there was, and this was, of course, after the direct searches at LEP, in the remaining parameter space, there were a bunch of points, so-called snow mass points and slopes, were selected as study points to compare the LHC experiments, linear collider experiments, and other things. And one can ask now, what has happened? What has been the fate of those points as time has passed? And of those points, 2 have remained that have not been killed by data. But the ones that have been killed, the B goes to S gamma transition has been as telling as anything else.
This is snow mass 2001.
I believe it was 2001, if memory serves, yeah.
Slopes.
Yeah, points and slopes, yeah. But and then recently, within the last year, Joanne Hewitt and colleagues did a fairly interesting study. So they stepped back and they considered the full, and as unbiased as they can, the full parameter space of the MSSM. And so they took 10 to the 7 points over a 19-dimensional parameter space of CP-conserving MSSM. And actually, they did both a linear sampling of the parameter space and a logarithmic sampling of the parameter space. The conclusions weren't that different, so I'm just presenting the linear sampling here. And So this is just an unbiased sampling. It has nothing to do with what had already been ruled out. They just wanted to see, you know, if the MSSM, you know, if that model is a correct representation of nature, what phase space is left? What kind of fraction of the phase space is left, and what kills the phase space that's already been killed? And you know, admittedly, it depends a little bit on what order you make these, you apply these constraints. But this Bigos, the S gamma constraint here, is about the most effective constraint there is on the full quote unquote unbiased CP conserving MSSM. So it is no matter how you look at it, this Bigos S gamma is a very telling constraint on new physics and in this example through the MSSM. And so it pays to continue to work on trying to improve that constraint, or actually use it to discover hints that will, fit in with eventual direct discoveries of the hadron colliders. Now, one thing that can be pointed out that if you start here at 10 to the 7th points and you apply all these constraints, and what is left is about 0.7% of the parameter space. So what can be pointed out is that MSM is already very tightly constrained. MSSM, the minimal supersymmetric model, is already fairly well constrained, and one can ask what this means overall for supersymmetry. But
can you go back a couple of slides?
Sure.
To the MA versus tan beta?
Sure.
Is the reason that there's a gap in the middle there that some of the diagrams on the previous page can move out the signs and the amplitude, or what?
There's an interference term, and for certain, so for certain values of these parameters, the net effect is too small to have been seen. All right, so there is an interference between the standard model process and the extended process, and they can be positive or negative interference. You can get positive or negative interference, and you can either see a deficit or an increase in the cross section.
There's
some.
So standard. Oh, I see. So if you had, let's say, MA of 400 and tan beta of 10. Those processes would still be happening, right?
Yes, they would be happening, yeah, but they wouldn't
interfere negatively.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I guess the exact region is eliminated depending on your super partner masses and all that, right?
So is that what the various dashes are?
Well, I'm assuming that this is integrated over the other free parameters, but that may not be the case. No, these correspond to different, I think, values of confidence level. But this arguably is a little contrived, but I think these show a little more objectively what kind of constraints are applied by the current measurements of Bigos S gamma, which are in a good agreement with the standard model. Okay, so you want to measure this, and what you need to do is you need to make a lot of B mesons, so you run it to 4S. And it's a resonance, but you can see it's kind of a resonance, a mild resonance, and there's a factor of, for every 4S event, there's a factor of 3 more continuum. So one has to worry very hard about, in addition to the backgrounds that come from the 4S events themselves, one has to worry hard about the continuum. Now, it turns out that the continuum is not such a problem, because it can be measured directly by running off peak. And so you get some amount of data off peak, you see what happens, you scale it up to the equivalent luminosity, and you can just subtract the continuum off. So really, the backgrounds that are going to wreak havoc or cause trouble are the ones that come from the Bs. There's only one in 1,000 or one in 10,000 decays are Bigos S gamma decays, and so the rest are backgrounds. Now, these are the samples, and they'll continue to run, but the bar has shut off. But between the two, they're accumulated over an inverse adiabatic of data. And this is substantially beyond what people conceived of originally when the B factories were started. So we are doing physics, as is always the case, we're doing physics that people didn't really think about doing when the B factories were first started. And these show the detectors are quite similar. There's some sort of silicon vertex detector in both cases, a drift chamber, precise drift chamber, a low mass drift chamber for doing precise reconstruction of particle states. cesium iodide electromagnetic calorimeter in both cases. The same solenoidal field, 1.5 tesla. The real difference between the two is the particle ID. And so there was a very clever idea using internal reflection of Cherenkov light, Dirk, internal reflection of Cherenkov light. So the idea is the particle comes in, and there's a Cherenkov cone of a given angle, given the particle's mass and momentum, and you know what that Cherenkov cone should be. And there's internal reflection, and that internal reflective light, the Cherenkov angle is correlated to a location in this phototube array that this light goes after it leaves this bar. And so that turns out to be a very powerful and innovative way to do particle ID, and it does give, I think it's safe to say, a bit of an advantage to the Bavar detector over the Bell detector.
Meaning you can go to higher momenta, or is it the...
No, it means you get a cleaner separation. Yeah, cleaner separation between pions and kaons. And that is, it is important, not so much for the S-gamma measurement, but for the D-gamma measurement, because for every S-gamma decays, there is one D-gamma decay. And so in order to avoid confusing them, you need to find the strangeness and eliminate it. So that's very important for the D-gamma measurement. Okay, but we're talking about S-gamma for now. And so the most exacting approach is kind of aggressive. And the idea is that you look for the high-energy photon, and that's basically all you look. You don't reconstruct anything. You just find a high-energy photon. And you can see that if you just look at all Bavar triggers, of course, this is a Monte Carlo, but this is what we expect to see in all Bavar triggers from the 4S. Here is this photon signature buried under a sea of background. I mean, this is a logarithmic plot. So orders of magnitude more continuum, and even an order of magnitude more BB bar background than signature. And then you're supposed to just find the photon and somehow know what you're doing. So how does that work? Well, so what one does is one uses event shapes to suppress the continuum background. So continuum tends to be jetty rather than spherical, and you can use things like this. And also require a high-energy lepton for the signature, because what that's saying is you want to take only events where you have an S-gamma decay on one of the Bs, and the other B decays semi-leptonically. And so the probability that a B will decay semi-leptonically is much greater than a continuum event having a semi-leptonic decay, particularly with a stiff lepton. And that, as we'll see, does a very good job of suppressing continuum. And as I said, you estimate the remaining contribution by scaling off peak data. That's not really a problem. The problem, as I said, are the BB bar backgrounds, particularly from pi zero and eta to two photon decays, where you miss one of the photons. Now, the interesting thing is if you look at the signature and you say, okay, well, this is going to really, you have to focus on your understanding of high-energy photon detection. But it turns out that it's not that difficult to understand how well and reliably one reconstructs high-energy photons. You can look at mu gamma, and you have a kinematic constraint. You can see that gamma. You can actually do quite a good job of understanding your reconstruction of high-energy photons. But it turned out from this process, it's a second photon that is going to cause a problem, because you need to understand what this background is. And when you require for your signature, one of the photons to be high energy, the other is going to be low energy, and you need to understand whether you find that low energy photon and put it together to make the pi zero and throw out the event or not. And so it actually turns out that somewhat paradoxically, the difficult, challenging thing we're finding in this measurement is understanding the low-energy photon reconstruction efficiencies. And we're talking about 30 to 50 MeV. So that's one of the paradoxes of the measurement. And I'll say a word or two about that. But in any case, you apply the cuts, the signal selection, so especially continuing with event shapes, et cetera. And
sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
It's on this page, too, I guess, but the... So the eta to gamma gamma is the blue?
Well,
photon energies, is that kind of a smooth distribution because of the...
It's 80% of the blue.
Okay.
And we'll see a full list of what the blue is made of in a second. But that's right. So So after all this event selection, this is what's left. This is a linear plot, and this was for our 80 inverse femtobarm result. So you can see that it's about a one-to-one relationship between sigma and background. The continuum is small after the selection and understood, and so the game is to understand this, as I said. Now, this measurement has been done by Babar, published several years ago, but with 81.5 inverse femtobarns, so that's about a fifth of the data sample. But look at what we're up against. After doing that measurement, well, we're doing about a 15% measurement, but this is the challenge, because it's statistics is not the problem. There's a model dependence, which I'll say something about in a second, and there's a large systematic, and that systematic basically arises from understanding your background. So even at this level of 81 inverse femtobarns, we're dominated by systematics. So to exploit this sample between Babar and Bell of over one inverse atobarn, we need to focus on reducing systematics.
So when you compare then the result with the model prediction,
The model is not the prediction. The model is, in order to extract the signal, we need to make certain assumptions about the spectrum. My next slide will be on this. Okay.
But it is uncorrelated with any model uncertainty in what you're comparing to.
The model uncertainties that go into the uncertainty on the experimental result are uncorrelated with the question of how the Bigos S gamma width manifests itself in this range of photon energy between 1.8 or 1.9 GeV and 2.7. Okay, so there's model error and there's systematic error. Model error, so this is the problem. The problem is that here are some various Bigos S gamma signal models, and you need to understand the efficiency because there is a different spectrum, and the overall efficiency for reconstructing Bigos S gamma in this range of, say, 1.9 to 2.7 depends upon the spectrum because there's a differing efficiency. And so this is a source of the dominant source of model dependence. And the idea to get around this is to simply flatten this out. So you can do this with some cost of statistics, and so that's where we're headed. And we'll reduce this, we think, to 3% or less just by being a little more careful in our energy dependence or our efficiency. So we don't think the model dependence is going to be a major roadblock here. But now to get to Max's question, so the blue background that remained, the BB bar background, these are the sources. So there are photons that come from pi zeros and eta's, other mesons, Bremsstrahlung, and then the catch-all category. And then there are things that fake photons. So you have an electron that doesn't leave a track in the detector, an anti-neutron, proton or anti-proton, etc. And by far the dominant cause of the background is pi zero and eta decay. Asymmetric decays where one of the photons is high energy, so that fakes your high energy signal photon, and the other one is not. And
what about K-longs?
That's down here, so K-longs, that's sort of a 0.8% contribution, and that's one that we understand pretty well.
Even when you're looking at the subsample where
this is the fully reduced sample, so we applied all cuts.
I guess my point is that you can imagine a competing diagram where you get a K-long and a charged K-on and a charged strange system that you're using to identify your
No, but we don't. This is a fully inclusive analysis, and we only look for the photon.
Just the photon.
So if you had a K-long, you know, if a K-long interacted early and had a very electromagnetic interaction, then it could look like a high-energy photon. But that's something I think we understand that process fairly well, and you know that that's a less than a 1% contribution to the background. The difficult one is the electron background. That's some real work to understand. This neutron, the anti-neutron background, that took some work to understand. Because the anti-neutrons, there's no track, and they go and they have a large cross-section, and they can imitate photons rather readily, and so that took some real work. And I don't really want to go into that, but we really thought quite hard about that and discovered the Janoff bug in doing it. But the real meat of this, the hard part is this. This is where we're now concentrating, is trying to get an understanding of this background, pi 0 and eta decay.
Let me guess, the bug was with n bars.
The bug was with n bars, that's right.
Was it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you put that in there?
No.
Yeah.
I can imagine that would be something that they might
have. Well, actually the bug was with p bars. And the bug was that if there's two different ways a p bar can. Let me see if I remember this bug now. So.
They don't get ordinary hadronic shower.
If they range out before annihilating in Janoff, they don't annihilate. So if a p bar in Janoff, at least the version we were using, if the p bar gets into material and stops because of ionization loss, it will not annihilate in Janoff.
Exactly.
Well, no. I mean, it should annihilate. And so I looked into this, and it turns out that the annihilation time is less than a nanosecond. You have to work very hard to get it above a nanosecond. So it looks like a Janoff bug. And I try and interest somebody in fixing that. It's a different story. But in any case, this is the background. So you have this an asymmetric decay. One of the photons is high energy, and the other one is low energy. And what you need to do is you need to find both of these photons. If you find the high energy photon, so it gets in your analysis, you need to go and you need to find that low energy photon and veto it. And for the most part, you're not going to veto your excess gamma events, but particularly the B bar background, you can do a very good job of vetoing it. But it turns out, although this looks like a very nice peak, you're only vetoing about half of them, because there are some that are falling outside the peak because of the measurement is not perfect. But even more than that, you find photons, the second photon goes outside your fiducial volume, or it's too low energy to be seen, or you have an inefficiency for it. So the critical part is to understand for this, so you have to realize that the dominant source of the background that I showed is for pi 0 and eta decays where they were not vetoed. So you have to have a very, very good understanding of your reconstruction efficiency for pi zeros. And you also need to know the production, because you need to know how many there are that were produced so you can know how many that were missed. And have the Monte Carlo help you to understand how many were missed. So you need to understand the production, and you need to also understand your detector response. So what's done...
Do you have the peak for the eta also?
No, I'm not showing the eta. It's all the same. Yeah, I don't want to waste your time, Matt. Whatever I'm saying for the pi zero applies to the eta also. So what we do is we take the cut on the high energy photon. So we, instead of requiring that it be above 1.55 GeV in the lab, we relax that to about 1 GeV. So we have many more pi zeros, and we can study pi zero production as a function of pi zero energy, and understand the production, and we can also measure the response function at the same time to understand how many are going to fall outside of this cut. The problem arises if you miss the low energy photon, then not only does it not show up in your production, but so you don't subtract as much as you should, but in addition, you tend to miss the veto of that when you try to actually veto events, so it actually comes and hits you twice. So you have a very large sensitivity to errors in modeling of the reconstruction efficiency of the low-energy photon. And that's what we found, and that's what we're working very hard on right now, is to try to understand that. And there are different ways to understand that. The best is to use some way of getting at it that was within the data itself, and looking at this is a very well-known ratio. It's a ratio of rho to pi production. Rho nu to pi nu decay of tau, and one can look at that as a function of effectively. You define this asymmetry, but it effectively is as a function of the energy of this low-energy photon. And so you can look at that, and you can see you have a very good constraint, except for when the low, when you have a high asymmetry, which means a very energetic high energy photon and a very non-energetic low energy photon. But the problem is, that's where all our signal lies. And so what we need to do is we need to try to work on this measurement to try and lower the backgrounds in this region, and so we can get a better constraint on the reconstruction efficiency of these low energy photons. So that's sort of what's going on now. And this appears as if it's going to be the limiting systematic. So this is the challenge this measurement is up against. Now the latest measurement is one from Bell, where Bell used, this is the old measurement from Babar, 15% measurement that I showed. Bell, within the last 6 or 9 months, has released a measurement with 605 inverse femtobarns. And this shows the center mass energy spectrum of the photon, which looks very much like the excitation curve that I showed before. And you can see that in this area, it's all background and no signal. So this is sort of a control region that shows that, at least at some level, they understand their backgrounds. But nonetheless, this is a measurement that's still limited at the 12 to 13% level. So even with 600 inverse femtobarns, Bell was not able to make a substantial dent in this underlying 15% error. Our goal is to get well below 10% in overall error. Whether we can do that or not remains to be seen. But you can see very clearly the problem we're up against is understanding within our detector really a response to low energy photons, even though it's a high energy signal. It turns out that we need to understand low energy photons.
The peculiarities of the detector give you guys an advantage with this particular analysis?
I do not know. I really don't know why it is that Bell. It's difficult to tell right now from what I've seen why it is that Bell didn't manage to break 10%. I probably shouldn't speculate, but there's at least preliminary number.
Yeah.
And I think it leaves a lot of room for improvement. So
did they have a previous result with the roughly 80 inverse
numbers? Yeah. We'll see that in a minute. We'll see that in a minute. So, but this is not the only way to address the problem. Another way to address the problem is to try to reconstruct everything explicitly. And so at this point, and this is something that only Babar has tried, and Babar has only done it with this 80 inverse femtobarn. So only a tenth of the world sample has been analyzed in this way, and we'll see that this is a fairly competitive measurement. So Babar reconstructed 38 of the exclusive Bigos S gamma final states, so K pi pi, where the pi's are charged or neutral, etc. 3K on decays, and that represents about 55% of the total width, and then one has to extrapolate over missing final states. And you can see a typical, this is the, for all these final states, this shows the excitation curve in basically the mass of the reconstructed final state. And you can see the signal here and the various backgrounds. And we'll understand a little bit better what this kinematic variable is in a few slides. But in any regard, it's a lot different than just looking for a photon and praying that you don't have backgrounds. I mean, this is explicitly reconstructing things. And these backgrounds are pretty much self-calibrating because you can fit them away. You can see their dependences in this region outside the signal, and you can use that to fit their contributions underneath the signal peak and extract reliably the signal. The problem here is correcting for the missing final states. And this shows sort of results, and including this is the excitation curve, not in terms of the photon energy, but sort of 1 minus the photon energy, which is the energy of the recoiling system against the photon in any regard. And you can see there's a resonant region down here where you produce K stars, and then there's a high-mass excitation here. And so one gets a result. In addition, one also does get a good idea by looking at these 38 modes how this system fragments. And that'll be important when we start talking about D gamma in just a minute. And so the result here is one that's fairly competitive with the inclusive approach. And so this shows the situation now. So here is the prior Bell result I guess it wasn't 80, it was only 5.8 inverse femtobarns, and their current result that's relatively new. And this is the Babar inclusive result from 80 inverse femtobarns, and this is the the bar semi includes a result of one I just talked about with 80% of barns. And then there's a result here, which is not really competitive yet, where you explicitly reconstruct the non-signal B in one of several possible final states and cut down the backgrounds that way, but it doesn't really come to the average. So, and there is an average that's available, which overall is about a 10% measurement. So there is definitely room to improve that if you can get better than 10%. Against the theoretical backdrop, which is a little bit muddy at this point, next to leading order was improved, and next to next to leading order, so there's a little bit, things moved a little bit more than one might have expected in going from next to leading order, next to next to leading order. And so there's a little bit of a range here that one has to reconcile. So the theoretical situation is not completely resolved either, but it's being pushed hard by the experimental results now, and there's reason to hope that there will be improvement in the theoretical calculations in the next couple of years.
So Bell must have been depressed that 100 times the data that they're representing them by factor 2.
Well, you see, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to tell. I'm not surprised they didn't do that well, but these things can happen. We'll see a result of ours where we got not 10 times the data, but another 20 or 30% of the data, and our errors actually didn't improve at all. That happens sometimes.
When you take the measured numbers and then, say, try to find its contours in MA versus tan beta, you have more theoretical errors that come in with the MSSM. Those aren't really reflected by those errors there, right? But are they on the plot?
Well, when you say theoretical errors that come in with the MSSM calculation, do you mean in terms of what the unknown parameters of the MSSM?
Well, let me give you an example. Like, when you do the search for charged heaps, the direct search, and you try to relate your exclusion of charged heaps to MA versus tan beta, just the one loop Suzy corrections can make huge changes to the excluded region. And I just wonder if that sort of theoretical errors incorporated or in some way.
I guess I'm not sure. I'm surprised that you can add a loop in a weak process and get huge changes. I mean, this is not the theoretical errors that are coming in here. These are long distance effects that tend to compromise poor Cajun duality. So in other words, the B goes to S gamma observed is not what you would exactly the rate that you would get from just the pure electron weak calculation. Because of these QCD effects. Actually, they're not long distance effects, they're short distance QCD effects. But that clearly, since they're strong forced effects, that is going to can change things around quite a bit. But I would be surprised that higher order electroweak effects can introduce that much of an uncertainty. But nonetheless, I mean, these are all weak couplings. So, I guess that may be the case, but if it is, I'm unaware of it.
No, if it's been analyzed thoroughly, they really wouldn't. I only say this because when we published our paper on the charging search in 97, a slew of theory papers came out just saying our limits were no good because we were making basically go away by putting Chargino loops in there instead.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, so that, yeah, okay, right.
Made a little career out of
right. Okay, so what they're saying is, okay, I understand. So basically, if you go back to the very first slide I showed, I mean, it's a question of what you put in the leading order Suzy diagram,
right.
What runs around there. Yeah, well, that may well be. But, what I presented was in the context of a very concrete model, which is MSSM, CP conserving. And in that context,
I think
it's a well-defined.
Well, the other thing I asked is that you wipe out our parameter space that we're searching and takes it out down.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there are probably ways to get around it. I'm sure that. Don't put down your tools. Okay, so that's B goes to S gamma. Now, B goes to D gamma, and normally what people say we're extracting is BTD over BTS. That's not quite the way I look at it. I'll talk about this, and I'll talk about the different approaches, including this new approach, which is a semi-inclusive approach where you try and reconstruct as much as you can exclusively again. And then I'll talk about the status of this measurement. Okay. So the idea here is that you have two different complementary approaches. You have a hadron collider approach of measuring VTD, and you have a radio penguin approach of measuring the VTD. And for a long time, you know, people were worried that we weren't going to do this, and that this was going to be the major way to measure VTD. Well, that's not the case. When V sub S mixing was measured, now that doesn't measure VTD, but what it does do is it measures, allows you to normalize out the hadronic uncertainties in the VIGOs, in the V sub D mixing. So in any case, once that was measured, then you end up with a very clean constraint on VTD in the CKM matrix. And we'll see that it's very precise. And then you can ask, you know, well, what role does this play? So I'll mention that. In both cases, it's critical that you only get the selection weak information by normalizing the B sub X process to the B sub D process, or in this case, the B sub D to the B sub S process. But in any case, you need to compare those and basically form a ratio of those two to extract, to eliminate the hadronic uncertainty, so to cleanly extract this electroweak parameter. Now, so relatively recently, within the last year, there was a talk by Francesca Di Ludovico from Babar, but she was just taking the existing constraints from the hadron colliders. So from B mixing from the hadron colliders, combining these two presentations, and her average showed a constraint on this ratio of parameters based on VTD, because VTS is fairly well known, with great precision, better than 1% experimental and a few percent theoretical. So how do penguins fit into the picture then? As you'll see, we can't do anywhere near that good. Well, if you ask, you know, what is the standard model width for this? Well, in mixing, the standard model width for B sub D mixing, which is where the sensitivity from VTD comes from, the standard model width for that process is about the BDK width. That's why you get mixing. For penguins, though, as we've seen, the branching ratio is down by 10 to the minus 5, so the width for this standard model process is down by 5 orders of magnitude relative to the width for this mixing process. So there's a suggestion that, just that argument would suggest that you can see much smaller, much weaker contributions of new physics through this penguin channel than you can through the mixing channel. Now, that's a very generic argument. Of course, it would have to be fleshed out in terms of actual concrete calculations, but at least there's a generic argument that suggests that once you, that this measurement, what this is really doing is it's fixing the electroweak physics, the standard model physics, by fixing this VTD parameter. And with that constraint, then one can use that as a very sensitive test bed for new physics. And furthermore, here's a quote from a paper that is motivating this measurement. In addition, so these vertices are CKM suppressed in the standard model, but new physics contributions may not follow the CKM pattern in flavor changing neutral current, and new physics effects may be even more discernible in XD gamma than in S gamma. So it's more sensitive, and in principle, even the new physics effects can be even larger in this channel. Now, I don't think that this is something that's been thought about completely, that this channel for discovering new physics has been as completely explored as the S gamma channel. So I would often put forward these arguments as motivation for doing so. Okay, so in any case, so let's talk about not the mixing, but the penguins. And so there's a relationship between the parameter of interest that luckily has a square, and that's helpful. And so initially we can start by looking at exclusive channels. So we can reconstruct rho gamma and compare that to K-star gamma. And there's a relationship with known parameters and parameters that one can calculate theoretically to about 8% overall accuracy. So you can measure this observable to about 8%, at least in terms of theoretical uncertainties. And so it's a promising channel if you can measure this ratio of these two branching fractions. So this is one approach. This is an exclusive approach. There's also a semi-inclusive approach that I'll get to in a few slides. So new results from this spring and this summer, Bell has gone up to its full data set, and so has Babar, at least as of that time. So we have an inverse Atabar now looking at this exclusive reconstruction of rho and omega to be compared to K-star gamma. And the challenges compared to the variance ratios are small, 10 to the minus 6, as I mentioned, for these exclusive modes. And the backgrounds are high. Continuum, we saw how to get rid of that. It's no different. And we're excellent particle idea, as I mentioned, is required because this K star, where K goes to K pi, if you misidentify this K, then you're going to reconstruct the state, but you're not going to understand that it was actually an S gamma decay and not a D gamma decay. So this feed-through due to particle misidentification is a critical background. And then you also have the same pi zero and eta decay, but it's not such a critical background there because there's lots of other ways to suppress dB bar background. And so what one does now is construct two kinematic variables, energy substituted mass, which is just basically a largely measurement of momentum balance, and this energy difference, which is a total energy measurement. So these are largely uncorrelated. And in this two-dimensional space, one can fit and separate out signals and backgrounds.
Is that different from missing mass, the top one?
Yes, it's different than missing mass. Well,
in the sense that we see it all, but
well,
you're getting the mass just from the knowledge of the beam measurement. And the
well, you know what the momentum resultant should be, just from this basic relativistic expression, and you know what this is from the beam. So what you're doing is you're comparing the momentum resultant you see, the sum of all the momenta, to what it should be. So I don't know. I mean, maybe you could call it the mass, but that's why it's sensitive. I mean, it's you're not measuring the mass directly. What you're doing is you're measuring a very sensitive comparison of the momentum that you expect and the momentum that you see. Momentum, and you're measuring the momentum balance because the momentum largely is going to cancel to give you a small net resultant momentum. It's very sensitive. It's about a factor of 10 more higher resolution than just measuring the mass directly. It's an invention of Clio. And in any case, you can see this is self-calibrating. You get, so this is, for instance, P0 goes to rho 0 gamma, and with rho 0 going to pi plus pi minus, and you can clearly see the continuum and contributions. This B goes S gamma feed through, luckily, can be separately constrained, and one gets a fairly reliable measurement of the signal. And this shows where we are, the latest L results. So we're sort of at the 20 to 30% measurement for all of these different channels. Then you need to put on your thinking cap and figure out how to get as much information as possible out of them. And so a somewhat specious assumption of SU3 flavor symmetry can be made. And this is a question that one needs to think about. If you go to much higher accuracy, one would certainly want to question this assumption that the rho zero and the omega decays have an identical width. And then a little bit of basic static quark theory allows you to write this relationship. And then you can do a single constraint fit for the overall branching ratio of B goes to rho omega gamma using all the information and compare that to K-star gamma, which is very well measured at this point, and extract a result. And so so we get, so Bell extracts measures a value of about 1.1 times 10 to the minus 6 for this exclusive branching fraction combined. Exclusive branching fraction leads to a VTD or VTS measurement at about the 15% level compared to the 3% level from hadron colliders. But again, I wanted to emphasize that we're looking for new physics by playing these two diagrams off against each other. And then a similar constraint from Babar, and overall we get a measurement at 13-14%. Okay, so that's the exclusive decay. Now the other approach, I talked about a semi-inclusive approach semi-exclusive approach for B goes to S gamma, where we reconstructed 35 final states. Here, we're only reconstructing 7 final states. You know, the number's a little bit out of order because we threw out a couple of these, because of 5 and 8, because we're having trouble reconstructing them. And so we're looking for these exclusive modes in XD gamma. So this is what we're trying to measure. And we're going to normalize again to S gamma by measuring the corresponding modes where we substitute in the S quark for the D quark. So we're going to measure this, we're going to measure that, take a ratio, and hope that we can extract in the ratio of the widths. Now, if we can do this, we can extract the ratio of these widths, then to get from that to BTD or BTS is very little theoretical uncertainty. So that's the real draw. If you look at the exclusive measurements, the theoretical uncertainties are substantial. Here, if you can do this measurement, then the theoretical interpretation is quite clean, at least according to this reference. But the problem is experimental. You have to correct for the unmeasured region. Higher multiplicity final states, more things in the final state, and also the region that you don't measure. So we look at the mass of what's recoiling against the photon. We can only measure in this region because, at least for now, beyond this region, we're very, very dominated by backgrounds. So here's really a better picture of what we need to do. So here's XD gamma and here's XS gamma. And then the new measurements, the XS gamma, you know, we've measured that all precisely. We're only measuring it again so we can have a direct normalization. This is what we're trying to do. So the exclusive measurement that I presented prior to this measures this component. And there's a little bit that's not measured, the omega. There's some channels there that aren't measured. We know exactly how the omega decays. So that correcting for this is not a problem. But this is the exclusive mode, and we were out to blaze new territory. We want to go to use our semi-inclusive measurement to go beyond. So we go to higher masses, so not just the resonance region, but we go up beyond the resonance region, and our 7 modes measure this much of that total decay width in this region between 1 and 1.8 in the mass of the thing recoiling against the photon. And so we need to know, well, what happens if we add more pi zeros? You know, there's stuff that we don't measure here. We need to understand what that is and correct for it. And what if we go to a higher number of bodies? We need to understand that correctly. And then, so there's the experimental question of understanding, you know, what you're missing and correcting for that. And then there's also the question of then, when you take this, when you understand that and make those corrections and take this ratio, there's also a region here, which is, you know, something about 40% of the decay width that we don't touch at all. So we have to extrapolate to get the ratio right, extrapolating for these unmeasured modes first, and we get a ratio between 0.6 and 1.8, and then we have to take that and extrapolate that ratio off into this higher mass region. So these are the challenges. Now, first of all, you can ask, how well did we do in reconstructing these channels? And so we can reconstruct these nicely. These are resonances, K star, the kaons we reconstruct nicely. This is the challenge here, so it's to reconstruct these 7 decay modes in this region here. And so that's the most challenging one I show here. And this shows what you're up against. It's the signal is a little hard to see, but it's this green blip here. Even with the good Babar particle identification, still the feed through, when you miss that kaon, and I think it's a pion, it's still substantial. And in addition, it looks quite a bit like the signal in this plot of this beam constrained mass. So the handle that you really have against that is a separation in this total energy measurement, because you misidentified a kaon as a pion, so you're missing some of the energy. And so it all comes down to looking at this plot and seeing that there's a 2 sigma excess in this region relative to the sum of this continuum background, which is well constrained, and then this feed-through background, which you can racially constrain by seeing that there's a lumpiness in this area, which you extrapolate, and that leaves a small excess here. And so it's very challenging. But we've spent a lot of time, of course, trying to understand just how well we understand these shapes, and there are various control samples you can use, et cetera. We're fairly confident that we've done the right thing, and we have a reliable extraction. And so So we have S gamma in the resonant region, high mass region, D in the resonant region. This is a challenging measurement, and we get a little over 2 sigma in that region. But overall, we get a 3 to 4 sigma signal overall from these exclusive modes. But this most challenging region where we add any extra information, it's difficult. But nonetheless, we feel we have a measurement. But we need to take that measurement, and we need to first correct for these unmeasured modes. And so how do you do that? Well, you start with your Monte Carlo, and you ask, what are we missing? Of course, you don't believe your Monte Carlo, so you have to say, okay, but how far off can the Monte Carlo be? But we start with the Monte Carlo. And the Monte Carlo, so there is, you generate a max mass spectrum of the stuff recoiling against the photon by a well-known and respected model. And then you take the XS system and you fragment that. Well, there's all the XS system, that's a relatively abundant decay. And so we understand that. So we can just put in experimental constraints and that's understood. The XD system, there's no constraint on. So that we fragment just via phase space. And now you say, okay, well, that's a Monte Carlo simulation, but now how do we really constrain that? How far off can it be? So we need to understand what the systematics of that is. So we start, well, in the resonant region, the Monte Carlo suggests this is dominated by resonances, and that's confirmed by the K-star dominance of B goes to SX, XS gamma. It's completely dominated by that. So the resonances we understand. So we don't have to worry about these extrapolations here. They're understood very well. But it's these extrapolations, number of extra pi zeros, the number of overall bodies, and in particularly in the XD, where we don't have experimental data that we have to part about. And so what we do is a couple of things. So what we do is we take both the XS and XD together, and we force them to decay to an unweighted mix of appropriate higher mass, available higher mass resonances. So there's a list of flavorless higher mass resonances, and this list of strange high mass resonances, most of them confirmed. And we just say, let's just make 50% of our decays into these resonances. Now, we know that when we do this for X of S, we get fragmentation that's inconsistent with data. So we think this is kind of a conservative model. But we do this, and we see what happens to the fragmentation.
If you do what, you get an inconsistent?
If we... 100%? No, even 50%.
Even 50%.
Yeah, so we take this prior Monte Carlo, and we cut away 50%. We remove and replace with this mix of resonances. And what we see is... We see the mass spectrum is ruled out. I mean, it's too stiff of a mass spectrum for the X of S system. But we use this, as some sort of constraint on, another pole for the fragmentation to manifest itself in. And then the other thing we do is we force the XD decay to be identical to the XS decay, so we have all this information on the fragmentation from XS, and we force that to be identical to that with the substitution of S goes to D. And that gives us another pole. And then we look at that, and from that we've concluded that what we should do is we vary independently the number of extra bodies and the extra neutrals by plus or minus 50%. And so we use that, we use the Monte Carlo to correct, and we use these variations to establish a systematic error and the correction for that. And so again, we're just using this to address the region between 0.6 and 1.8, but this is our primary experimental result then, is once we correct for this, for both X of S and X of D, and then divide, we see a ratio of partial widths restricted to this mass range of 3.5% with fairly large errors. And still statistics dominated. Now, this is a large systematic, but again, this can improve with internal constraints just as the X of S system has allowed us to constrain that internally. So it's a systematic that can scale if one chooses to do this with more data. So getting close to the end here. So the next thing you do is then to extrapolate to the full width. So again, what we've done with this measurement is just to get the ratio of widths for this section. Now we need to extrapolate to this width. And it appears that there is not much uncertainty, luckily, in doing that. We've tried a number of different models, and there's very, very little difference in the ratio of those partial widths for the between what you would get restricting to this mass range between 0.6 and 1.8 and just going out over the full mass range. In fact, it's negligible. Then this is something that we probably need to think about a little more, but it looks actually quite good. And certainly at the level of errors, when you compare it to this error that arises from this extrapolation to unmeasured modes, it seems quite small. Luckily.
This is the full Bavard data set?
This is the full Bavard. No, it's not quite the full Bavard data set. But there's only about another 15%. But this is a first stab, and so there are ideas that we're pursuing, including more modes and going to higher mass, hopefully. So hopefully we'll get a ton of improved measure. But in any case, you can take this experimental result and then extrapolate it using the models to extrapolate it beyond 1.8, and it doesn't change. So you still wind up with the same result. The model suggests that the measurement in that restricted mass range is the same as you would get over the full mass range, again, because we're measuring D and S gamma, a ratio, so these uncertainties cancel. And you put it through the machinery of this paper, and out comes a measurement of BTB over BTS with an extremely small theory error. And this has actually been accepted now at PRL. And so this is the situation. So we have the exclusive modes. We're measuring rho, omega, gamma, and normalized to K star gamma. And averaging these, we get the result I showed. The semi-exclusive one that I just showed, the measurement I just showed, on the paper, it looks somewhat worse. But the point is that, unlike this, there's no correlated theoretical error. And so it actually does a reasonable job of reducing the overall error. So the radiative decay average now is something that is at about the 10% level for VTD over VTS, as opposed to 3% for B mixing. But again, what we're looking for is to play these off against each other. And it's becoming, believe it or not, even the radiative penguin measurement is becoming a precision measurement now. You can see that at the 10% level, it's starting to really close in it and give a fairly precise constraint. Now, again, I would, and there is no evidence for non-standard model contribution. They're in good agreement. But again, I wonder whether this would provide an even more exacting constraint on extensions of the standard model than the S gamma. Again, I don't think that's been thought through. Okay, so that's it. So just to conclude, so the Vigo's S gamma continues to be a leading constraint on models of new physics, particularly SUSY. And there's more Bavard data that exists to improve the measurement. But we're running up against difficult systematics. A semi-inclusive approach, only 10% of the world's data has been analyzed in this way. And Bavard is now concentrating on finishing its analysis of the full data sample here. So there's still plenty of room to go. We expect to make good progress here. We also expect to make good progress here. So it's hard. Even though B factors have stopped running, it's hardly over. The radiative measurements of BTD over BTS are becoming precise. And in comparison with B mixing, the agreement is good. But I question whether, but there's a suggestion just from basic order of magnitude scaling arguments that this should be an even more sensitive channel for looking at new physics than the S gamma. And I'm just, I question theorists whether we've really thought that through completely. Thank you. Not that I'm aware of. My impression is that people started to think hard when these hadron collider results came out. They're all the way at the beginning of the slide. So the measurements that come from comparing mixing, from the mixing sector, are very precise, and that inspired a lot of discussion and contemplation of what we would expect from mixing from extensions to the standard model. But there are calculations coming along now, within the last 12 months that look at effects of new physics on the B sub D mixing rate as normalized to the B sub S mixing rate. but ones that address this question of what kind of constraints you would get from the this Vigo's XD gamma measurement, that I haven't really seen. I haven't, you know, when I was at the CKM workshop in September, you know, I raised this, and you know, the impression I got was that you know, that it really hasn't been looked into. You know, and who knows?
Put in a charged Higgs contribution, for example, how does that scale relative to the S gamma?
Well, so you know, I would ask, you know, what are the CKM like coupling parameters there? I mean, if the charge Higgs has a difference, so we go back to the very very first slide here. You know, if it has a different CKM structure than the standard model, then in principle it could be much more visible in D gamma than in S gamma. Right, because this in D gamma, this for the standard model, this is suppressed by this, you know, additional factor of 30. Whereas if there's a different CKM like structure here, it might not be suppressed for D gamma relative to S gamma.
But even if it were the same, is the S gamma or the D gamma more sensitive?
Well, the S gamma is more precise. Is more precise of a measurement. In terms of the transition width, the S gamma is known to about, as I showed, about 12 or 13%, whereas the D gamma is known to about you know, 20 to 25%. That's right, and the S gamma is, you know, roughly a factor of 2 more precise at this point. The width is known to, you know, 11-12%, and the D gamma, you know, 20-22% right now. So, but it's a different CKM structure than it's likely that this coupling would be larger for D than S relative to what it is for the standard model, and it would tend to show up in D gamma.
The charge enograph, I just been a while since I looked at that. Is that also just directly proportional to DTD?
I have no idea. I couldn't begin to answer that. So, I mean, a Susie phenomenologist can answer that immediately, I think. But,
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Some kind of random mixing there. That's my memory.
Yeah.
You know. So,
yeah.
So I would think that if you have a light Chargino sector with a random mixing rather than a DTD, if that kind of stop, which is supposed to be the lightest quark state anyway, that you might have gotten. Much bigger result than you would from the charge states graph if you follow the standard CKM.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if this is putting some very strong constraint on either the mixing stuff in the Schwarz sector or the Chargino mass or, you know, some combination, of course, with the reality.
But right.
So you've seen no analysis of that. Right?
I haven't. I mean, that's the reason why I make this point. I just don't think that people have appreciated it. The reason why they haven't appreciated it is because they always, when people ask to hear about this, they always ask to hear about VTD over VTS, and they don't. I don't think there's an appreciation that you've got two different ways to measure that, and so what you're really doing is you're playing these two things off of each other to look for new physics, maybe even more likely showing up in the radiative penguin process. Whereas, I think people just haven't.
So this wasn't.
They haven't realized.
The Hewitt-Pritzoe scan. And
no, definitely not.
Calculation.
Yeah.
No,
it was not. Yeah, I just don't think people have I think they've always seen this as this D gamma measurement as a CKM measurement and not as a new physics measurement. And that the point I've been trying to make is that I just don't think that's the way to look at it. And for that reason, you know, I just don't think it's really occurred to people. Now, to be perfectly candid, some people at the CKM workshop where I raised this and said, well, there may be some problems with this BGOS do the D gamma width because of light quark loops. And so that was perhaps a limitation in the ability to... Yeah, that's right. So that would be a problem in the standard model prediction, in making precise standard model prediction given VTD, what you would expect. So, but that, I haven't seen anything formal about
that. That's a VTD measure, but you're looking for new physics, a factor 10 bigger, or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that point's well taken. So... But my point is that I just don't think people have fully digested this, because it's kind of, you know, kind of broken in the last 2 or 3 years that you can start to make reasonably precise measurements of this decay width.
Other questions for Bruce? I have a general question. Since the experiment has stopped taking data, what's the sort of general lay of the land in terms of people finding manpower and new students to analyze the mountains of data? Is that not a problem?
No, it is a problem. I think so far, you know, it seems like most of the critical analyses are people remain. I think that you kind of get going on an experiment and it becomes fairly easy to do the next analysis,
yeah.
And so I think it's a natural thing for people to keep grinding away. But you know, I think that I really can't put my finger on any particular ones. But I think that some of the less sexy analyses are probably not going to get done at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I was a little surprised, you know, when I made a little bit of a stink about this semi-inclusive thing. I said, you know, somebody really should do this. I was a little surprised to be disabused that. In fact, there was a group, a Caltech group, that was working on that. I didn't even realize that. So there are definitely people on the bar that are still attacking this. And I think, you know, as far as Radio Penguin goes, all this stuff, I think you're going to see updated to the full data set and you know, with the latest reconstruction. So I have complete confidence that all these channels are going to be pursued. You know, other areas, you know, I can't really comment on.
And just remind me, Bell is going to keep going for a while? Or?
Yeah, you know, I think they've got another year or so. You know, I probably should know a little better, more precisely than I do. Bell has always been manpower limited. I mean, their collaboration is about a third of the size of the bar. And so I'm not quite sure just how deeply they're going to be able to dive in some of these other approaches to measuring B sub S gamma and B sub D gamma. So that I can't say with any confidence. I mean, I think there's a lot of opportunity for them to do that, but I just don't know whether they'll be able to do that. And of course, they're interested in you know, the next generation machine there.
Right.
So presumably they're starting to...
Next generation of what machine?
Super B.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what is the time scale for the Super B or some sort of...
Well, I think if they had their way, it would be 3 to 4 years. But I doubt they'll have their way.
What is the cost of the Super B now?
Boy, I don't know, half a billion, as I seem to remember, but that was, yeah. So.
Can they reuse anything?
Yeah, I think, well, it's a tunnel. But I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know.
Do the detectors have to be redone because the power rates or whatever?
Yes. I mean, I'm not sure the drift chambers are viable. And I think that may be a problem. I haven't really followed it. A couple years ago, I was following a little more closely. But if you lose your drift chambers, then you're going to start to lose this very, very precise mass resolution that you get from tracking wherever that was. I mean, it's. I mean, if you look at these, that's way down here. If you look at these excitation curves, I mean, it's. Okay. So yeah, these resolutions, you know, are down at the 10 MeV level. Of course, this is a beam constrained mass, but still, I mean, it comes down to how well you can measure this momentum balance, and it's really that's
the
critical.
Momentum balance a little bit more closely.
Well,
that's the take away the gamma.
Now, all you're measuring is, you correct everything to the center mass frame. You're just measuring the mass, not by, usually the way you measure the mass is you just form a momentum resultant. Right? The m squared is the sum of all the four momenta, and then you square that. That's the way you usually measure a mass. But here, you're not doing that. You're measuring the mass by using, the famous relation that mass is E squared minus P squared. And so you're not measuring, what you're doing here is, so in other words, this momentum is going to be very small, right? Because the mass of the meson is almost the beam energy. And so what you're doing is you're trying to understand, you're basically using, the precision comes because these momenta cancel each other out almost to zero in order to do that. I mean, this momentum, the square of the momentum is very small because this mass is very close to the energy boundary. And so you get a great enhancement in the precision. I think if you just did
you're not using that as a, you're not forcing that constraint, you're actually measuring that variable.
This is well known.
Yeah,
this,
right.
Yeah.
The PB, you're just taking the three momenta that you see and summing them
that's right.
together,
right.
And then you're plotting this MES. I couldn't follow it all at the time, but I guess I've seen that. You're plotting this MES,
right.
And it should peak at the, at the B.
Yeah. I mean, I suspect
let's see, but there's a B and there's a B bar. So let's see. So when you look at P star, it should be. Oh no, this is the 4S mass here. Oh, okay.
Yeah. But actually, as I think about it, the precision probably comes if you just take a first order Taylor expansion. There's probably a PB over E or PB squared over E squared. So the uncertainty in PB is probably suppressed by that ratio. I mean, the uncertainty in mass is probably suppressed by the ratio of the three momentum resultant to the energy per squared.
I'm confused again. You're doing a BD bar final
state. No. This is there's a B decay and a B bar decay, and you look at one or the other of them.
Okay, so what are you doing with the other B when you construct this? It's a semi-leptonic. You claim that you know how to separate the particles into hemispheres or something.
No, you don't know how to separate them. What you're doing is you're just taking, let's say you're looking for k pi gamma. You take all the kaons and all the pions and put them together and a photon. And if it's combinatorics, it usually lies way out here and way out here. So, but if you got the right, the point is that the combinatorics lie out in these long tail backgrounds in this two-dimensional distribution, and so you basically just take a k on a pi on a photon and form the mass, and you see a mass peak. And so, and the other b you're just ignoring,
right,
basically.
It's
or
it's not giving you k's or pions, or if it does, it's out on some tails.
Well, no, lots of times you mix them together. You'll mix together a k on and a pion, but then that completely screws up this momentum balance, and the thing lies way off over here.
So then you only take the bends to bring that peak.
Well, what you do is you take all events that lie in a box in these two parameters, and then you do fits, and you know what the continuum looks like, and not only that, but you know it comes out here. You constrain the continuum height here, and the BB bar backgrounds are really very tiny here, so they just lie outside this box.
Yeah.
So and you just basically fit for the size of the backgrounds. Yeah.
Okay, thanks again, Bruce.
Okay.